This is an interview with Judy Christie and Joe Kyrgios on the 28th of April 2012 at Judy's home in Forest Lodge for the Shared Terrain Oral History Project on behalf of the City of Sydney History Unit. And just for the tape, Judy, can I have your full name and your date of birth?
Full name's Judith Christie, and I was born in 1952 out in Dubbo.
Okay, great, thanks.
Just test that.
Well, Judy, I've come to talk to you today partly because of your passion for birds and, if I've understood it correctly, habitat within the urban area. But so that we can just start with a bit of a context and background for you, can you just tell me a bit about yourself and where you've come from and something about your work situation?
Okay, so I was born in the country and grew up there, a little town called Gilgandra. Not on a farm, but my mother was on a farm out of town, and so we spent a lot of time on that farm on the weekends. Came to boarding school in the eastern suburbs for 6 years when I was 12. Went to Sydney University just across the way. Did a bit of travelling. And then basically wanted to come back into the inner west because that... I think that was where you wanted to be in the 70s. And, it was just sort of coincidence that I sort of ended up in the Glebe area, really. I must live here, but we'd had a house here when I was a student with some friends, and I had another flat when I came back from overseas. It's a nice area, Glebe. Although I was never particularly part of the academic community or anything, or the Glebe Society. I've probably always been a bit of a loner. But I've been in this tiny little house on the edge of a cliff in Forest Lodge for about 28 years, mainly because I don't know where else to go now. So there are things I really don't like about it. And a couple of things I really like, mainly the one thing I really like is the aspect, sort of you're on top of a hill and you're looking out, you have a view, which I've mainly put trees to block off now, but I've watched the suburb evolve. In the mid-90s, met up with some people living nearby who were very passionate about keeping a little wild kind of gully that we had. And that took about, how long? It was about 96. Oh, a long time to resolve.
Well, that's probably a whole story in itself, so I figure that we'll spend a bit of time on that, if we can, on the gully. What have you been doing work-wise here since you settled in?
Well, I was a high school teacher for many years, and then I worked in mainly teaching Indonesian, Asian studies. I was sort of interested in that and history. That's the sort of area I was interested in. And then I worked in the Adult Migrant English Service for about another, 6-7 years or something. Did some books. So I was interested in language and culture, I guess, and how people communicate, where they come from, different people. Always been interested in different cultures, particularly Asian cultures. But also quite interested in gardening. Didn't really know, I think always kind of looking for something.
Any interest or in the outdoors?
Well, yeah, I didn't really, I mean, I'd never bushwalked or never camped or anything until I went overseas in my 20s, mid-20s, late 20s. You know, we didn't do that in my family. We went on holidays. We certainly didn't pitch a tent.
Did you have things in your background that you now look back on that you think influenced your interest in habitat and birds and...
No, it's funny, really. I think it's really just something you take for granted. If you and I think that's why it's so frustrating to see the built environment, you know, taking the concrete taking over, and a really limited suite of plants being put back. Because I don't think there was anything particular in my background except that we were outside, and you just, you took it for granted that you were outside and there were trees, and, you know, nobody knew the names of the birds or anything, but, you know, they were there. And I think it was just being able to be part of that and have taken that, I think you just took it for granted, and I think it just, it's there, I've got friends who have similar interests to me, and they had quite different upbringings. Some of them, you know, they spent a lot of time bushwalking and camping. I didn't. I probably always wanted to know things. My interest in birds is interesting. I've tried to work it out where it came from, and I think it was a boyfriend I had, who was a funny sort of a fellow, but he knew the names of birds, and he loved animals. And I can remember going and staying with his brother up on the North Coast, and they had the Reader's Digest book of birds, and I was just so impressed at these people who weren't particularly well educated and were hippies mainly, sort of weren't in well-paid jobs or anything, but they knew the names of the birds and what they were, and I thought, well, that's a really nice thing to know. And so my interest was almost a want to know and a knowledge. It wasn't something in my soul or anything. It was almost an intellectual interest, but nonetheless an interest, you know, in the same way. And I think people can come to things in all different ways. I don't think there's one pathway to caring about the environment. I think people can come to it from all different ways and in all different sorts of places. And so I'm sure there are people who can have a very urban upbringing who can still be quite passionate if the opportunity's there. And I think that's important. So, yeah, so I decided I wanted to know about birds. So I sort of self-educated, joined a few clubs, and I continued to be interested in birds and got involved with other people who did, and that's nice.
And I was just wondering, when you said that people can come to appreciate nature, birds, etc., from all sorts of different angles, do you say that because, obviously you've been thinking about it, but do you say that because you sometimes have a sense that some people think that one should come from a certain background? Have you had some pressures?
No, I haven't personally, but I think there are stereotypes, and the greeny thing is a really problematic stereotype. I think the sort of thing, you know, suddenly I'm into politics. Christine Milne saying, I'm going to go out and engage the farmers. I think that's a fantastic kind of thing, because I think having come from the country, and we still have a family farm, so we don't run it or anything. We have a manager. We don't really have any but we do have a link to it. So you understand how people who are stewards of the land for productive purposes, they care about it, but they care about it differently. I was sort of distraught out at our farm a couple of months ago when I saw that our manager had set up a little feedlot, and there were two trees that I really liked that were dead. But I thought, well, you know, he's looking after this land in the way he knows best. He's, you know, and it wasn't down to me to say, you know, you should have fenced those two trees off. She had, though. I can't remember what we were talking about. So I think people can. I think that, you know, oh, you're just a greenie is a really problematic concept, and I think people who say it are very ignorant of kind of what it means to care about the environment, because you can care about it in all sorts of different ways, and you know, we'd be better to have a different name for an environmental organisation, or, you know, or an, you know, the political group. It's not useful in some ways. But poor little bird out there, I've chopped down half his tree. It's always a compromise in the inner west between space and sun and nature, and that conflict I have daily in this backyard, as to how much I can leave to enjoy, you know, a few birds, and how much I can, you know. I just took out a tree last month because there was no sun at all and I couldn't see anything. And it was a bit hard to do, and I think the birds have probably suffered a little. But yeah, so
well, just... Actually, we didn't also talk about what your current job is and your last... And then we'll get, I think, to the backyard.
All right, so that's right. So I was interested. I couldn't work out what to do with myself, and teaching I didn't think I was very good at. And it certainly was very challenging, although I enjoyed the English migrant stuff. But I kind of had to make a choice between, and I'd started, so I started doing horticulture 3 years at TAFE. So I did, so I'm a horticulturist. Did a bit of gardening, a few gardening jobs, but I kept my teaching work going as well. And then 1 year I had to decide whether to do another course in bush regeneration or to do some postgraduate work in linguistics, and the letter that came back first was the bush regen one. So I went down that pathway. I probably should have gone down the other pathway. I'd have been financially a lot better off. But instead I took that sort of bush regen pathway. And once you do bush regeneration as a course, which is in those days it was a TAFE course for about 6 months.
And when was those days?
About 1995. It's a bit like a religion. It gets you. And because I had the birds, because I'd sort of been following the birds, you know, getting involved in birds as a hobby, I thought I needed a hobby. I kind of had that already there, and then I was starting to learn the plants and understanding ecosystems. I didn't really... You know, I haven't got a science degree or anything like that. But if you observe enough, and having observed birds and bird life and pursued them and seen where they were, you can intuit a lot about ecosystems and the environment. And so then I learned about plants. And I had learned about plants from a horticultural point of view prior to that. So I think I've actually got quite a broad practical knowledge. And I find a lot of my colleagues have science degrees, but they actually don't know what plant is what. And I find a lot of people out there working in council don't either.
And when you say colleagues...
After I sort of took a voluntary redundancy from the Adult Migrant English Service when contracts dried up there in 98. I worked for 5 years at Greening Australia. So that was quite practical sort of work. The job that allowed me to segue from being writing books on literacy to planting trees was a small grant, which was to involve people of different backgrounds, culturally diverse backgrounds, in environmental improvement activities.
Around this area?
Yeah. No, Western Sydney. Sydney, yeah. But, I mean, I'd already worked in Cabramatta. My literacy book, which they told me they'd do a small publication, and 10 years on, it's still out there. I wrote in Cabramatta. So I kind of had some links out there. So I became put on my Greening Australia shirt and my boots and went out and kind of did stuff out there. It was interesting. I'd had a fear and horror of Western Sydney, particularly, you know, those of us who started teaching with the department in 1975, you know, there were all those great big high schools out there in the western suburbs, and it was kind of ugh. But it was interesting to go back out there 15 years later, working on there's a whole lot of public land, the Western Sydney corridors, which is the rump of land that was supposed to sort of be the green belt around Sydney, which has got chewed almost to non-existence, but there's still a bit of it. And in those days, Greening Australia had the contract to do sort of improvement on that land, which was owned by the Department of Planning. I kind of started looking at it with different eyes, and I can remember saying to the guy who was my manager, I said, it's interesting, there must be something in my memory that, because the trees, it's box woodland, looks like where I grew up. It's box woodland. I mean, I never knew it was box woodland out when I grew up in Gilgandra, but by now I did. Mm. And I realised sort of, you know, and I felt quite comfortable in some of that landscape that we used to work in Western Sydney. And I decided it was because it hit something in your memory. And it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, so I've actually always thought about that, you know, what imprints into your memory. Now, there's nothing here that imprints into my memory, I don't think. I think it's just that I've been here a long time. And so it's that, you know, it's like a place you've lived in for a long time. There's just something comfortable about it, even though you might hate the bloody, you know, plumbing and the, you know, and the fact you can't park anywhere and the noise and... But there's other things that are comfortable. So after 5 years of working in an NGO, planting trees and working with different cultural groups as well, I did a lot of that. So that was nice. It was because I had skills from the Adult Migrant Service, and I had the contacts, and I was able to kind of, you know, do something useful. But I then got a job with the newly formed Catchment Management, Sydney Metro Catchment Management Authority. So pretty much for the last, it's been 9 years, and it's been pretty much up and down. But the bulk of my work has been sort of what they call community engagement, community support, like a land care support type activity. A lot of it's been project management, which is pretty boring. But a lot of it's been working with people. And because it was a new organisation and it was a new position and a new role, I have been able to sort of create it a bit and create things that... So we run an annual community forum, which, you know, I first conceived of in 2007, so we've just had a sixth one, so it's been really good, and everyone talks it up, and it's seen as the one thing that people all over Sydney do. And I've set up some baseline surveys of volunteering. So I've done a little bit of research just for presentations and things at conferences on why people volunteer in the environment. So professionally I'm interested in that. And of course with the birds, I've also been very privileged to have worked with the birds in what's now BirdLife Australia, but was then Birds in Backyards, Birds Australia with Richard Major and Kate Ravitch, and that's been fantastic. So I've always just done that as a volunteer thing, and it's been wonderful to have that contact with scientists, and you know, people who are passionate about educating others about the love of birds. So I have my work. Well, I mean, a lot of it's just, you know, day-to-day stuff, you know, putting together project ideas, doing newsletters, you know, that sort of community engagement stuff, putting on events. But it's given me... But the interesting thing, and I think the thing I really like, is that it's all over Sydney. It's regional. It's like... And so I've observed, you know, the passion people have for their patch. But I often feel I'm standing apart from it a little bit.
Why is that? Just
I don't know, because I think that. I've lived everywhere, you know, I know all different parts of Sydney. I don't, while I've lived here, I wouldn't say I'm passionate about this part of Sydney.
Right. But, so maybe this is also a good time to tell me about your patch, though. And could you actually describe, for somebody who just doesn't know this area at all, tell us where your house is, and looking out onto your backyard, where we're located.
Okay. So Forest Lodge is a really densely inhabited part of the western side of Glebe. It's all old houses. This house is 100 years old. It's tiny. It's falling apart. It's on the edge of a sort of sandstone cliff. But there was an opportunity when I first came here to sort of plant a few trees, and I don't know how you describe it. It's people live very close to each other, but it's not high rise, although high rise is coming on all sides of me now. It used to have a lot of... We used to have a hospital, the Children's Hospital, which was like a lot of places in Sydney. It was sprawling. There were sort of hidden gardens. You could wander around it. There were little wild places. There were sort of old gardens. There were old trees. There were new trees. And there was a fence... there was a sort of an area on the edge of it that looked like it was a no man's land. But when they decided to sell the Children's Hospital to a developer, turned out that all of that land did belong to the Children's Hospital, and so they were going to develop it all. But I think certainly when I first sort of came to live here and in the 80s and early 90s, there were lots of nice little wild places. They hadn't put a fence along the concrete creek, and it kind of had a sense of being part of the landscape. There were lots of little wild places. There were lots of birds. Things hadn't been manicured to death. And I think even 20 years ago, if you went into a nursery, there were more plants. There was more diversity. And that's been frustrating, to see the limited kind of opportunities from commercial nurseries to plants. So you walk along, you'll see about three species of plants, and that's about all everybody uses. It's awful.
And now tell me why it is awful.
Well, for a start, diversity is to get more insects, to get more birds, to have different niches for different small urban creatures. You need diversity. Diversity is what keeps life going. You know, if we were all a single, you know, genetic strain, we'd all probably be dead. You know, I mean, diversity and genetic diversity and species diversity, that's what keeps the world going. And it's almost what why I think I'll probably have to leave here is because there's almost nothing left of that diversity anymore. It's become so uniform. There are no wild bits left. And although, actually, that's not true. There are wild bits, but what's happened is a couple of species have, plant species, have taken over. And so there's a particular tree, which Joel Johnson might have referred to as a problem in Glebe, which is the Celtus, which is just weeded everywhere. And now it dominates all the tall tree canopy. And so you don't even have... They're taking out eucalypts left, right and centre. Yes. You don't even have some of those, or they're putting in the wrong ones under putting in a, like you see a Eucalyptus maculata put in under power lines. You go, no, this is a big tree. What are you doing? It's just like, I don't know.
Let's go back though to, let's be historians, okay. And take me through the pathways that went from the hospital, okay. So the Camperdown,
yes, yeah.
Children's
yeah.
Hospital, okay. and take me through
yes,
that process.
Yes, that's a good story. It's interesting. So there was this sort of wild area. It's about 5 minutes walk from here, and one occasionally used to walk through it. I didn't take much notice of it, but I think you take for granted some of those places that they exist. You just, you know, it's just a bit of a wild area. Didn't have a name, wasn't named or anything.
But like, where was it from?
Yeah, 5 minutes walk. Just on the back of the hospital. So the back fence of the hospital, if you like.
Right.
And one day, partner who was living here at the time came home and said, "Oh, I've seen a notice up there. There's a group. I think they might have announced that they were going to sell the hospital. There's a group having a walk through the area down there to tell them what's there." And I was busy doing something, so he went and he said, "Oh, it's quite interesting. Those people. I think by that stage had I done my bushwood yet? I don't know, can't you? I think I did, yes. I think I sort of knew what I was talking about. Thought I knew what I was talking about. He said, "Oh, that wasn't too bad, you know." So then there was this local meeting called. So we went to that. And there were a couple of, interesting little group. The way these sort of groups form in any area, really. It doesn't have to be a city, but... So they were a couple of people who lived across the road, and they wanted to form a group, and they wanted to protect what they called the gully. And so that was all right, so I sort of got involved with them. So, again, you find people don't know much about plants, but they said, there's birds. And so what I did was I helped run a monthly survey. So for about a year and a half on, the fourth Sunday of the month or something, we'd do a walkthrough. So I've got all the data from that, year and a half. And they got a reptile guy to come out and, had a list of the reptiles. So the idea that we formed was that if we showed that this actually was a little urban wilderness of value in terms of the wildlife that it supported, then they would keep it or restore it. The developers.
Okay. Yes.
But I mean, in those days, that was South Sydney. That was South Sydney Council, and Leichhardt. It was on the boundary. Hundreds of hours spent putting in submissions and doing stuff.
And what sort of trees were there?
Just weeds. Yeah. Privet, few seltas, nothing like now though. Palms, privet, lantana, olive. Yeah, the main ones, I think.
And the birds?
Birds were good. They were a lot of honey eaters. I can remember seeing 9 or 10 white-plumed honey eaters there once. There were a few superb fairy wrens. But I used to have superb fairy wrens here as well, you know, in the backyard in the early 90s. I used to have them nesting here. After the bushfires, 94, summer of 94-95, in Lang Cove, there was actually, a couple of years after that, there were a lot of small birds came around. spinebills you'd see in the street. I had it in the garden. I had white-plumed honeyeater trying to nest in a moraya. And the bulbuls used to nest in a prickly little conifer that I had. Now they weren't native trees. It's not so much about being a sort of native Nazi and saying you can only have natives. It's about diversity and creating habitat niches. That's what I think. Because I've seen it, you know. I mean, birds will take birds and reptiles and bees. Like yesterday, there's a lovely little teddy bear bee, which is a native. He buzzes. He's a solitary native bee, and I've seen him the last couple of days. Is that him? No. He's really gorgeous. Coming to the basil. So it's like. I get a real pleasure out of seeing something, you know, unique and really gorgeous that has managed to stay in this urban environment. And it's having lots of little places for it and niches and different plants, different spaces. I'm not even sure where they nest, the blue-banded bee that I get is nests in between bits of sandstone, so I think it's probably in the foundations of the house. So you can see I've just about lost all the small birds here. What I've got are the bees.
And do you have a problem with big birds?
Oh yeah, well it was the big birds that ate all the bulbuls. The bulbuls in Glebe were gorgeous. That was the first bird I ever identified out of that when I was up the North Coast with that Reader's Digest book of birds. And you know, when I first decided that maybe birds would be interesting, it was about 1986. And I can remember turning the pages and there was the bulbul, which is not a native. I said, I know that bird. That's the bird that comes into my garden. And they nested every year for about 10 years in this tree, this prickly conifer. And I can remember in winter down near Arundel Street seeing like 50, 60 bulbuls. But every year, the cowhawks used to come and eat them. I used to hate it. I actually chopped down the tree because I couldn't bear to look at it any. I couldn't bear the. And the cowhawk would just wait. And they'd wait until the babies were born. And then they would eat the babies. And even in winter, I'd see a cowhawk going in and putting his beak in to see if there was anything in the tree. And it was horrible. So I chopped the tree down. It was a prickly, horrible thing anyhow. But, you know, the bulbuls liked it. And actually a superb fairy wren's nested in it 1 year too. But there's one bulbul left, I think, in Boyce Street. And it seems to be on its own. They've all gone. All gone. And it was a love there. They were a caged bird from China. They adapted very well to the inner west. I think they were around sort of in a circle from about Paddington to Glebe to out to here.
They were a bit of an issue for some people, weren't they?
They weren't native, but and you get a few on the edge. You get a few in You do get a few in the edge of bushland, but they're mainly in disturbed areas.
So they weren't a bird that chucked other birds out of nests colonised areas?
They were pretty. They were pretty. And
so what happened to them?
They got eaten by the currawong.
They really...
I'm sure.
Is this currawongs...
We got currawongs? Mm. Because of the obsession with fig trees. I really hate the obsession we have with fig trees in Sydney, starting with that Botanic Gardens. Was it Maiden? Who was the...
It did start a while back.
It started in the 1850s or something. Whoever was the director of the Botanic... of the Botanic Gardens who decided fig trees were the go. Well, fig trees everywhere. And still... it's a Victorian era, so we'll plant Victorian. Okay, we'll plant more fig trees. What do we end up with? Bats and currawongs.
And seeing as we're on currawongs, that's an indigenous bird, etc. What are your thoughts on how we deal with indigenous birds like currawongs that are, in fact, highly destructive?
Here now, it's pretty hard, isn't it? I mean, I don't dislike them. I mean, there was a little one. Down and look quite young in my tree yesterday. So that's all I've got now. So I've got to enjoy them.
Because I can see you've got some native miners out there, the old noisy miner as well.
Yeah, there's nothing. There's no choice. That's what we've got. They're part of nature. I'd much rather have had the bulbuls and the superb fairy wrens, but hey, I haven't. Just looking at the raven.
Heck.
That's it. That's we've created the environment for these species to, predominate. And I don't see anyone chopping down the fig trees, so I don't think it's going to change.
And so now that they really are the birds, currawongs, noisy miners, anything else?
No, not much. Not much.
Yeah, crow.
The ravens are very clever. They're very clever. This lovely friend of mine who really was the one who started the passionate gully, Orphan School Creek gully story, she sent me a whole email the other day about this, her raven, and, how clever it was and the interactions with her cat. And it's there's pleasure from those birds. Not the same pleasure that one had before, but I think... Yeah, I'm not about shooting them or killing them. And I actually don't mind even my Indian miners. I mean, I've got a pair. They're here. They don't displace anything. But it is... the noisy miners, it is a shame that they throw things out. What I've got, because I'm on the cliff and because... You do sometimes get things to just pass through. And so my pleasure from nature is really that serendipitous visitor that just happens for 2 seconds even to rest up in the acacia decurrens at the back of the yard.
The acacia what?
Well, I've got a few acacias, but there's an acacia decurrens. That's the big tree. Right. That's the big tree up there. Planted... in 2002, after the Department of Housing chopped down all the other trees that I planted outside the fence. I know that because my neighbour rang me. It was World Environment Day. She said, "You may not be happy, but someone's come and chopped down all the things that you've planted." Thank you. That happens a lot. That's happened about 3 times over the last 25 years.
Big trees that would have...
No, nice dense shrubs that would have provided habitat for lots of things. And I said to these guys, they were netting the cliff for pigeons. I said, why did you chop down this grevillea? Oh, well, just so I could get past it.
And a grevillea, which obviously is a...
It was a dense prickly grevillea that would have held the cliff together... And I never was able to get anything to establish again after that. But anyhow. So I do sometimes get little things, like a couple of weeks ago, it might have been only last week, I was sitting here and I heard a bird call. I thought, that's an eastern rosella. And I went out, and he was just over across the lane. It was an eastern rosella for about 5 minutes. I haven't ever recorded an eastern rosella here in 27 years. So it was the first eastern rosella I'd ever seen in Upper Road. But the call, it's the call. I've also had two winters ago, there was an immature golden whistler that spent about 3 months in this part of the globe. And again, you know, I came out one morning and heard this whistle in the garden. I thought, that's a golden whistler, what's it doing? And rushed out, and there was this little brown, you know, so sometimes the young ones, they disperse after breeding, you know, in winter before breeding. And he was just, it's the second time it's happened in about 15 years. It's not like it's that common. But he was lovely, and he used to kind of, you know, whistle in the morning and just was around the garden. And I heard him a few times also in the other trees around. So that was always what we thought about the gully too, in terms of revegetating it, that it was really to provide passing habitat for if there is another catastrophe, if there is another fire, you know, it's there. So you do get some of that migratory. Yeah, there was I had a male leaden flycatcher one afternoon, a couple of spring or autumn, can't remember. Might have been autumn. No, it was spring, I think. Again, it's the call I heard. You can hear an unusual call. I think that's what I love most about birding now is that, and I'm not musical. I've got a shocking ear. I can't sing. But after a while, you do pick up calls, and you can hear something that's different. It gives me a lot of joy. So it's that, you know, there is a lot of pleasure in that. And I think if I was in an ordinary backyard that wasn't on top of a cliff and falling down, I probably wouldn't get those sort of birds coming in.
And because you've made sure that even though you've knocked down a few trees, you've still got plenty of trees out there.
I've still got plenty. That's right. I've still got plenty. So, and that's right. And mostly acacias, but you know, there's a lot of grass, and there's bits and pieces, and it's just structure too. I think, you know, something for the birds to sort of rest on, because they'll come north south, and they can sort of rest up.
So should we go back though to the Orphan School Creek?
Oh, we should. Yes,
we're just migratory birds.
It's a bit depressing. I can't. It was so hard, and for so long, you know, we worked with the developer. We put in. I remember writing the submission, asking for a setback. So to the master plan at the master planning stage. So we put in a submission. I think asking for a 20-metre setback along that what we called the creek to sort of be a habitat area based on the evidence that we'd collected of what was there. And I think we got a 15-metre setback. And we also asked, you know, that it be, you know, pulled down incrementally, that we, you know, maintain the habitat.
Right. Yeah. What would be pulled down?
Well, they had to kind of, it was all fill. It was all, they'd tipped out all the contents of the incinerator over the back fence. So this was basically over the back fence of the hospital. So it was just contaminated fill. So it had to be removed. And so all the vegetation had to be removed. It took about 15 years.
So they did take it out bit by bit, or did they take...
No, they just bulldozed the whole bloody thing. And
so hence lost all of that habitat in one go. Yeah.
And then there was a lot... And then we tried to get... There was other land that belonged to Westmead Children's Hospital, and there was land next to it that belonged to Leichhardt Council. One was a park, one was, you know, I don't know, something. And they argued for about 5-6 years about how much to pay for it. It was a land swap. And in order to get this land swap so that we could continue to create a sort of a habitat corridor, I think the Westmead Children's Hospital wanted, you know, money, wanted the land valued as if it was going to be developed. Leichhardt said, you know, well, no, it's going to be parkland, therefore, you know, we only want to pay so much. So they argued and argued and argued, and nothing happened, and the weeds kept growing. And we all felt pretty disillusioned. And then the boundaries changed, and we became part of the City of Sydney, and we got all terribly excited. We thought, oh, it's now going to be all solved. This will be good. And certainly the City of Sydney, it still took a while. I think Westmead Children's Hospital was a pretty tough negotiator, but they eventually got the land swap, so we thought, all right, now our plan for this sort of vegetated corridor and trying to create the gully again. And we had a landscape architect who had lived locally, who was working for the developer. It was very complex, so I must say I kind of lost the plot after a while. I couldn't remember who was supposed to be doing what, and you had different contractors looking after different bits of it, and it was drought time as well, so a lot of stuff died. We were trying to get local provenance planting, and then there was this god-awful outcome, and I don't know. The city, when it first took over this area, wasn't very communicative about issues, and I think, and look, I don't know, you know, it wasn't possibly an agenda. It was just the way things were. But so people got letterboxed, and it sort of said, you know, they're going to be developing this habitat area, and the plan was appalling. It had this zigzag path destroying it all, and oh, we had. Really very nasty, unpleasant kind of scenes with the city. We all felt that our vision had been kind of totally compromised. It's been a couple of years now, and a couple of weeks last month, I got a couple of people who lived nearby who were passionately involved. And we did go back and do a little weeding. And I think it's almost possible now to get a few people to go back, and we may try and get a group back together again to look after it. But it was such a painful experience that people, we had to walk away from it. It's a hard thing for, I guess, a new council like the City of Sydney to sort of come in and without understanding the time and the passion that had gone into creating this habitat concept. And for whatever reasons, plans had gone ahead without consultation. There were individuals who were perhaps hard to talk to, and other issues came up about, you know, possums and. But I think ultimately we'll end up with something, but we don't have anything living there anymore. There's no small birds or anything there. So the whole there might be the odd lizard, but I think it's. There's no other patches anywhere. It's all so isolated. And there's this great big bloody concrete bike path going in down there. They're taking out all the vegetation that was there.
So I was looking down, so just below you, that that orphan school creek
yeah.
goes for a long way, does it?
No, that's Johnson's Creek.
Oh, our creek's just over there to the left.
Oh, I see.
And I mean, it was great the way people found out that it had a name, that it was called Orphan School Creek. I mean, and there's quite a lot of history in this area. You know, it was a farm, it was a forest lodge, it was a, I think in the 1790s, it was an estate of you know, some of the early officers of the came on the first fleet or soon after. So you know, it's a very old area. It's very hard to, you know, it's hard to see the landscape. I was talking to you before we started taping. It's hard to see the landscape now, and it's frustrating. It frustrates me that we don't try and put some of it back when we can. For example, the Harold Park, that actually is a creek going through the middle of Harold Park. So I wrote a submission at the early planning stage saying, and it had been mentioned in one of the reports that it was a possibility that you could actually put that creek back. They never do it. They just concrete it over. They could put the creek back.
In an urban area, how you talk about a bike path down there in such a...
It's huge. It's a great big wide thing.
So yeah. So is that the problem rather than the idea of being able to have a shared space, which yeah. might have a...
You've got to have that. It's what they did with the gully as well. They took so long. They got incompetent contractors. They planted the wrong trees. I had to email about 5 times to get the city to come and take out the Acacia salignus, which were planted by mistake. They're a weed. They're a West Australian plant. You might know them from South Australia. They've taken off in Sydney. They take over. They're a nightmare. How many? 8 or 9 were planted over here in the, you know, the city's kind of... was supposed to be a habitat area with a small playground. It became a big playground with no habitat. And Acacia salignus. I mean, God. I just, you know. And then all these other horrible trees, these hybrid things. I think they're just...
Yeah. So I was also like to go back to... some of that we were talking about, the land form and the landscape, because I came not actually knowing this part of Glebe Forest Lodge. I really didn't realise that there was such a slope down to that. That's Johnson down
Johnson's
there.
Creek.
Right, Johnson's Creek. So talk to me a little bit about that, because I think...
Yes. So you've got the creek lines. So Orphan School Creek was a waterway that rose and the Glebe Society has a lot of this history, and it's great, and it was the Glebe Society who said, when we were as a group in the mid 90s were trying to sort of work out what this bit of wild area over the back fence of the Children's Hospital was, they found that, they said, oh well, it was a creek, it was called Orphan School Creek, it was piped underground in 1915 or something. Because of typhoid or something. So it was a waterway. And then it goes into Johnson's Creek, which sort of rises over about Parramatta Road, comes down and goes into Rosehill Bay. And it is quite a steep drop. I used to, when I was growing up in Gilgandra, my grandmother would come into town on Fridays, and whenever it was raining, she'd say, to my aunt, we better go, creek will be up. And that was always a sort of, you know, you better go, Grandma. You know, you won't get home, the creek will be up. I've always enjoyed kind of the creek down there. I always sort of think when it rains and it's high tide, oh, the creek will be up. But, so Johnson's Creek, it's...
And does it come up?
No,
because it's...
Flooded in 1819, flooded the first couple of years I was here in the late 1980s. First 1980s it flooded down into those... But it hasn't flooded since.
There's a lot of houses down there now.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, we're housing. Oh, Sydney's built on floodplains everywhere. It's appalling.
And so I think you were saying that, especially in your own job and really looking at that whole Sydney landscape, yes. It's a complex landscape, oh, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes. So here you've got these creeks, short little creeks running into, you know, they're little estuarine creeks running into the bay. In this case, Roselle Bay, there's one, and then you've got Johnson's, and then you've got White's Creek. And so it's very steep and quite rugged. But you've got your ridge lines are sort of shale, so like Glebe Point Road runs along a ridge line. I've spoken to people, and it certainly had a big impact on me, but there was a book that came out in 1990, you've interviewed Doug Benson.
Yep.
This was a seminal publication, I think, for a lot of people in Sydney.
This is the Taken for Granted.
Taken for Granted.
The land of Sydney, yep. And its suburbs.
Yeah, it was a seminal publication, and I think at that time, certainly around here, that was when people were starting to go, well, what was here before? And, you know, how can we, you know, get it? Well, I don't know if there was even a sense of wanting to get it back, but a sense of kind of recognition of what the landscape might have been. And there were people who lived in this area who, you know, started community nurseries, who often they weren't terribly scientific about what they did, but they had a passion, and you can see it in the land. And then, so the community drove the councils. This is sort of like our council now. And I guess a lot of the people here enjoyed, you know, the community liked taking that initiative, and did a lot of planting. But Doug's book, Doug and Jocelyn's book, actually going sub... It's so typical of Sydney that it looks at the suburbs and the LGAs, and so people go, oh, my suburb. Oh, right, okay. It was shale sandstone, you know, transition forest or whatever. And it actually was quite inspirational and meant that you could... And picked out remnant trees and things like that. And this sense that you could put back. We had, and that was what bush regeneration and that sort of ecological restoration concepts were quite strong, had been strong for a long time in Sydney from the 1960s. Different from, say, Europe and America too, in that we still had something that was, you know, remnant here. Now, here you haven't got any remnant. I was always amused at that very first meeting I went to with the gully, and this, you know, bright young man said, oh, those trees, they might be remnant. I thought, my God, you're an idiot. I mean, they're 10-year-old hybrid, you know, I don't know what they were, but I thought, oh, God, you know, so people wanted this. You know, so there was a sort of, a hope that, you know, maybe, you know, but it isn't. This has been settled for, you know, 200 years. You're not going to find, you know, your soils are barely, you haven't got remnant soils, you haven't got remnant vegetation. You've probably got remnant rocks. Although, of course, they've excavated. Most of these cliff lines aren't natural cliff lines. They've all been quarried out. What did we build Sydney with? You know, we built it with this sand. The buildings in there, we built it with this sandstone.
So this cliff that you're on,
yeah,
that would have been quarried.
It would have been quarried. But I mean, it still would have gone, you know, the drop to the creek line is still. Mm. Is still, you know, it still would have been quite a, you know, hilly, but it might have been more of a hill rather than less of a cliff line. Cliffs are really good for you know, habitat and, you know, for little things. I once, one year, mid-90s, I think that was sort of after the fires. We had pardalotes. I think they just, you know, there was so much burnt landscape that they were sort of spreading out into the suburbs, and we had spotted pardalotes. And I can remember seeing one sort of investigating over the back of my fence, looking at that sort of where it was sort of chopped down. Probably got eaten by a rat, but you know. A cat.
Well, what other wildlife do you see around the place? Obviously bees and...
Native bees and us. I've got lots of skinks. Spiders can be very enjoyable to watch. And they're everywhere. Here comes the raven. Hello, raven. What are you doing here today? I've got a book where I sort of wrote down all the birds I've seen since 1987, which was when I started bird watching. So I've got a continuous list of what I've seen here since 1987. And so your small birds are gradually sort of gone. The honey eaters are gone now. There seems to be a single New Holland honey eater over in Boyce Street as well, which is kind of weird, along with the bulbul. I don't think they're breeding. What do they call that when they're... Yeah, I mean, they'll all drop off their perch soon enough because, you know, they're not breeding. The extinction debt, that's right. Extinction, Harry Recker's extinction debt. So... Dragonflies are nice. The bees are nice. Little skinks are fun. And then you've got the birds popping in and out. And then, see, they've got the wattle birds are still around. I mean, they're big birds, but in the breed, they were breeding quite successfully. They were breeding. Last year I had two young ones in the garden early summer, and this year I'm sure they bred again because for a while there the wattle bird was just going back and forth and back and forth because I've got a lot of sort of lush greenery. You get a lot of those little sap sucking insects, sort of little kind of triangular shaped pale green sap sucking insects. They seem to really like that Panaeopsis I've got there, and the wattle birds, they love, you know, those, particularly when they're feeding young, they'll go for those insects. So you get a lot of them coming through. So, I mean, you need the trees to have the insects to have the birds. And the wattle birds are quite nice.
Yeah, I like wattle birds.
Right, yeah, they're quite nice.
So what were some of your favourites? Well, that's probably a... Not sure that's a very useful question, seeing as they're not there anymore.
Well, obviously, we all love the superb fairy wrens. And I guess the thing is, you sort of took it for granted because they were around, they were popping in and out to your bird bath. Yet, by the time really, when the children's hospital went, that was really all of those little hidey holes, all of those little niches. And I think even if we'd have got the gully... Even if we'd have got what we wanted and it had all happened quickly, I still don't think it would have been enough because, you know, what we lost were all those wild areas and those sort of little corners of wildness, you know, and a sort of rampant plumbago here and a bit of briar rose over there and, you know, a climbing this and a climbing, you know, and a bit of a wild wisteria halfway, you know.
All just those things where the little birds could hide and live.
So they've gone. And so if you go over there now and in the housing, it's concrete, it's rows of buxus hedges, it's, you know.
What sort of hedges?
Buxus, you know, that Chinese, you know, box hedge. It's boring as all get out and has no habitat value at all, although I'm sure something must live in it, but I don't know what. I've never seen anything in it. So there's nothing. There's none of that creative kind of spaces that... And you could do it. It's not that hard to do. And I think That's why I'm frustrated with Harold Park, that they could... I mean, they have said they're going to have... what have I said? You know, bird habitat, backyard, some, you know, a bit. But it's... I don't know where they'll put it. But we did get something, you know. I've sort of burnt out, really, because the Children's Hospital, you know, sort of a 15-year battle does burn you out.
Absolutely. But from... Now, I was talking to Katie Oxenham.
Katie's great. She's got energy and she's also a scientist. She knows what she's doing she's come out of an organisation that was very bureaucratic as well, so I think she seems to have the capacity to deal with a bureaucracy that obviously has to be, you know, a complex bureaucracy that is the City of Sydney. So, yeah, we're all delighted that Katie has got that job. So took us a long time to get it. Yeah, yeah.
When you say we...
Well, we lobbied very hard to get somebody who knew, get somebody employed, you know, an urban ecologist, to get a biodiversity officer. There was one councillor. I can't remember who she was now. She didn't stay long in the council, but I can remember an email from her saying, it's the last thing I do. Get a biodiversity officer for the City of Sydney. So because I could remember sending, you know, Marrickville, I had the brief through my work. I sort of am aware of what different councils, you know, do, what sort of staff they have, how they support them. So somewhere like North Sydney is just brilliant, you know. They do. They have habitat officers. They have a big bush care program. Now they've got the coal loader and the sustainability centre. It's just fantastic. So they're a model, you know. But they've got a lot of money.
But they have... Yeah, it is different, isn't it? Don't they have more...
They've got a bit of bush. Yes. Yeah, they do have a bit of bush, yeah. Yes,
they have to look after in a different way than...
That's true, Jo. Yeah, that's... Marrickville's probably closer, but then they have the Cooks River... but, you know, Marrickville is probably a better comparison, but it's obviously not a big, you know, city council, whereas at least North Sydney has that city to look after as well, the CBD type thing. So I guess it will happen gradually. There's plenty of knowledge in Sydney as a whole of what we can do, but until we can ask developers to create some of these spaces, it's going to be tiny. And then look how, you know, what is it? You know, a couple of square metres is my backyard. I mean, it's like it's nothing.
Although, I think it was Doug who was saying that he really thinks it's important that even small backyards can have...
That's nice of you to say, Doug. Really, really. I've heard him say that about Cumberland Plain, and I think it is important in Cumberland Plain. But I mean, you know, it'll keep a skink or two. It'll keep somewhere for the spiders, you know, and the occasional. But nothing's going to breed. Although the wattle birds breed here, but they breed everywhere. You know, I think that might be a gum tree over there. But if we don't put gum trees back somewhere, we got problems. I've got acacias, but you know they're getting a bit.
They only have a certain lifespan.
Yeah, I'm worried about, you know, what's going to happen with that. I've got, you know, because I don't have any real sun anymore, because it's the sun's the north to that side, and everyone's trees are that. So I really don't have any sun anymore. I can't really put native shrubs in anymore. I've got a bit of a rainforest coming down the right hand side. So there's only so much you can do.
Just wondering who's in the tree next door. That's somebody.
Yes. Oh, it's just my neighbour.
Oh, a person. Oh well, that's a
avian. He's got a chair hanging. Right.
And you said something about the possums, that possums were seen to be an issue.
There was a friend of mine was feeding the possums, and so they were breeding up, and she had a great big camphor laurel in her backyard, and they were sort of living in the house, and they did overbreed, and
they can do that.
Yes, and. Well, and we all saw possums for a while after she left. We called it Roberta's diaspora. They started spreading out. We go, oh, that'll be one of Roberta's possums, because she left the area and there was no longer feeding them. And we want to go, hey.
Talking about being able to develop habitat, what are your thoughts on Barangaroo then?
Oh well, I haven't looked into it in great detail, but to put back a headland, I think, and to restore a landscape, I think is such a wonderful concept. And nobody seemed to want to talk about it. I feel very frustrated that there's that sense that we just have. It's the city, and keep nature somewhere else. I think we can put nature back into the city, and but it needs some sort of commitment, and it also needs the plan. We have so much trouble with the landscape architects who just don't seem to have a sense of kind of having some spaces that aren't just for people to be in. Spaces for other things, because we're all part of the environment. People are part of it, so are the spiders, so are the ants, so are the birds. And let's make some spaces for them somehow. If they can do something at Barangaroo, and I think, again, something about the, getting the topography and understanding that it might be the city, but there are creeks, there are hills, there are kind of ridges, and there are headlands, and Sydney's particularly special like that. And it would be a shame that to lose that. And I mean, mostly it's there are some nice leafy places still in Sydney. Yeah.
I mean, we've been talking around my next question, I think, but nature in the city, how do you conceptualise nature?
Well, it's obviously a different, it's going to be, some of it won't be, it'll be, like what Tim Lowe talks about, and his sort of feral future. And, it's obviously, probably is a feral future, I've been looking at the spotted turtle dove up there the whole time I've been talking, So, I mean, certainly nature will not necessarily be, the original nature. It'll be a construct of some sort. But I think, so but it would really my concept of kind of a shared space is really and I think that's a really good way to conceptualize where we're going is that rather than having nature out there and people here that it we do have to kind of conceptualize a shared space. So that so people see themselves as part of an ecosystem that has birds in it and plants in it and insects in it, and it makes it richer, makes life richer and more complex. I guess that's what I think. Mm. And it's possible. Yeah, it's possible. Doesn't happen as much as you might like to think it could.
Let me just stop us there for a little bit.
On the track?
Yep.
I was going to tell you about the most dramatic bird story from the backyard. It was only a couple of years ago. I used to have the ivy had got completely out of control down along the fence, so it was pretty densely vegetated, and there definitely was a rat. Sort of, I could hear it at night, sort of running up and down the fence in the ivy. And one Saturday morning, I was sitting out there, and this bird kept sort of seemed to sort of dive down onto the fence. And I thought, oh, it's a bit strange. I wonder what that is, big bird. It happened a couple of times. And I thought, oh, I wonder what that is. And I sort of got a glimpse of it, and I thought, oh, it's a bit late for a co-el, because it seemed to be stripy. And I didn't really think about it, and then I went out. When I came back a couple of hours later, the bird had come down and it had knocked over a rake on the table and sort of seemed to have dived down into the middle of the table. Flew off. But I had to go. I came back. It was like the scene of destruction. There was sort of blood. And there was this sort of the rat's tail hanging down between the rungs of the chair. And then I found the stomach of the rat, and I found this sort of patch in front of the mirror on the left where obviously a large bird had sat and eaten the rat, and there was this scattering of the skull. And I realised that it actually, and I sort of thought then, what was it that I saw that I walked away from? And that it was a goshawk. And a brown goshawk, which apparently I then looked up, in early autumn, young brown goshawks are known to come into urban areas. And so they skulk. They just hang out in trees. You don't see them sort of flying around. They hang out in trees, they skulk, they see something. So this brown goshawk had actually taken a rat in the middle of that tiny little garden. It was quite a shock, you know, because I'd gone off with a friend and she'd gone home and I'd gone home, and then I sort of saw this massacre. And I said, you better come and have a look at this. It's really, and it was quite extraordinary. And I actually saw the bird again, you know, about a week later. It sort of skimmed through I was sitting down the bottom and it skimmed through the trees. I've never had a brown goshawk before or after come into the garden. But, you know, so it does happen, you know, and I guess I'd be saying to people, observe, keep your eyes open. You know, there's experiences out there that are really, really quite special. And the fact that you have a rat running up and down your backyard is not nice, but hey, it can bring you a brown goshawk, you know, and you can actually have this, you know, you can, it's, yeah, it was amazing. It was quite extraordinary.
It's a lovely story.
It's really bizarre. Yeah, yeah. But I'll tell you about the blue wren, shall I? Completely different?
Yes.
Yep.
Well, just before we do, because we'll remember about the blue wrens, I'm sure. We were just looking at the photo from 1983 of your backyard looking out over the...
Yeah, very different, isn't it?
And yes, because we can see, we can see out into the buildings, but one of the things... beyond, you said also that one of the differences in that view now is it is much greener, and I can see that when you look out. Well, what is it that, are they not the right sorts of trees that have populated that landscape of roofs that we can see in that 1983 photo compared to today?
They're a mix. There are some good trees out there. There's a lovely... they planted them, the units that are sort of down on the creek, sort of below me, were built, just been finished when I bought here, so they were built about 1983 as well. And they planted quite a good range of native shrubs. If you look at the styles of fashions of planting in Sydney. It's quite fascinating. In the 1950s, 60s, it was all Eucalyptus microcorus. So tallows became, and you can see a lot of tallows now planted around Sydney, which don't seem to have great habitat value, but there's a few tallows down there. But one of the other ones is a Eucalyptus, it's a yellow bloodwood. Creeper, is it? No, it's not creeper. Anyway, it's yellow bloodwood, and they're lovely. And that gets a lot of habitat value. So, yeah, there are some good ones there and some bad ones. There's a lot of plane trees, which you can see starting to change colour down through there. They said there was a massive fashion for planting they're everywhere. But it's a North Coast rainforest tree. When I saw it on the North Coast, I thought, what a gorgeous tree. What a terrible thing to do to these trees, to make them become street trees in Sydney. But, yeah, look, the trees are okay, but it's what's underneath them that's the problem. And I guess because we've planted so many trees, we have got sun problems. And they're such tiny backyards. It really needs a different concept in terms of how we manage kind of landscaping. I think, you know, it's sort of, and I mean, people talk about the savannah, the parkland, the savannah landscape, and you know, this is what people are comfortable with, and it goes back to our, you know, caveman days, and you know, there's all sorts of theories about what sort of landscape, you know, people are comfortable with. But again, I'd come back to diversity, I think, as kind of a core principle for our landscaping, and lots of little niches. And I mean, everyone talks about corridors, but I don't know whether corridors are going to work particularly. I think it's more those sort of patchy, you know, really good patchy stuff. And it is unfortunate what's happened in Glebe with the Celtis. I can see a real, you know, I've lived here off and on since 1974, for goodness sake, so I didn't know one tree from another, though, in 1974. Nor did I, not when I lived here in 1977, I have to say, or even in 1979. But you know, I do now, and I can see a real difference. Just the fact that this particular tree has just taken over every kind of little wasteland corner. And the city has decided that canopy is what they're going to be used to measure. I wrote a submission with a colleague, with a friend, to the Master Street Tree Plan, just asking for diversity, asking for some eucalypts, just, and saying, if you're going to measure canopy, why not try and have some other measures as well, some understory measures, just, you know, to just measure canopy is, I think, useless as an indicator of anything except shade. And if that's all they want to measure, they're not measuring biodiversity, they're measuring shade, which in actual fact we've got a lot too much shade in some of our places, so it's frustrating.
Ever complex.
Yes, it is complex. It is complex, yeah. So it's greened. I think the greening is certainly nice. It's probably brought more noisy miners and carawongs and... But hey, I guess, you know, it is... There have been a lot of... I mean, in the 1980s, there was a lot of eucalypts planted too, and they were great big ones, and a lot of them are being taken out now, and you get this kind of, you know, neighbours all standing, you know, fighting the removal of a tree, but the poor person who's got the tree in their front yard, whose house is being tipped over by the roots of the trees, going, look, I've got to get rid of this tree. People love trees as long as they're not sort of, you know...
Uprooting their house,
you know, It is tricky. It's really tricky, which is why the public spaces need to be really carefully planned we were very upset with what the city did with what we thought was going to be a habitat garden with a small playground, and they handed it over to the children's playground landscape architects, who took over the whole space and then said, oh, it's all right, we'll put a few shrubs over there, and, you know, it'll be all right. And it was, I mean, I guess they, yeah, it's a densely populated area, they had to kind of make compromises. And they'll always be, have to make compromises. But I guess communication would be, improved communication can never go astray.
So can you tell me then about the Blue Wrens?
Okay, yes. So I sort of developed a reputation as somebody who knew something about birds over the years. One day this woman who I'd met through work, who lives down the other part of Glebe, came running up and said, oh, look, he's got these Blue Wrens at the back of our yard. So, could you come down and have a look? And so down I went. And there in a yard much smaller than mine were some wrens being fed. They were breeding. And I had given up on wrens breeding again. I knew this particular area because I'd seen wrens feeding a cuckoo down there, 91 or something like that, I think. So I knew it's a park close, just this side of Glebe Point Road. So I'd known it as a place where there had been a family of superb fairy wrens for a long time. And I didn't, you know, I had sort of said to people I didn't think there were any more superb fairy wrens breeding in Glebe, because there used to be some down in another part of Glebe. You know, you, if you walk around, you kind of, you know, you can hear them, you know. So they'd pretty much gone. So it was very exciting when these were, you know, when we saw these. It was about 2005 or something. So, and that was the first year the city then announced environmental grants. So the same lady who'd, you know, taken me down there said, she must have been 2006.
2006.
Yeah, it was 2006. Can you, we can do something for our wrens. And I just had my first hip replacement. I've had three, so. Yes. Nobody should have three hip replacements. No. Any rate, so I had some time. I was mentally, you know, I'd had to have a couple of months off, so mentally I was kind of more open to doing something. So I pretty much wrote the grant, got a few people around the table, and we wrote the grant. And then the Glebe Society said they wanted to actually run the project, which was fine. I've never joined the Glebe Society. I can't remember now why not, but it seems like for so long. So that was fine, and so this other lady eventually found some people who were members to run it. But I've always been involved as a technical advisor. And it was a bit of a struggle, but I got a friend to write the, to do the, you know, to be engaged as a contractor, and she wrote the report, and then the group sort of consolidated as the Blue Wren Group, and it's now pretty much the Blue Wren Group. It has its own rationale to look after biodiversity and small bird habitat, but not just small bird habitat, also sort of biodiversity in the area, and it runs planting days, and I think it's a wonderful thing.
And what's their, how do they feel they're going, I suppose? Are you still part of it?
Yeah. Well, it's sitting within the auspices of the Glebe Society, so it's a subcommittee of the Glebe Society. It's one step forward and three steps back and another step forward. So we had a planting day at this Paddy Gray Reserve for National Tree Day, which was part of the project that I'd originally written. And then a year and a half later, contractors came in and removed all the plants. They were sort of Irish backpackers. Joel would have... That's possibly the problem with Glebe that Joel alluded to. So, so these contractors just removed most of the native plants that we'd planted. It's happened a couple of times.
Right.
Because they don't have the skills and knowledge to know what's what.
Mm.
So it's a problem of outsourcing contractors without... And I don't know why. They've now got a new officer who I think has a background in bush care, and hopefully she'll rail kind of move us towards what we want out of the City of Sydney. But certainly a meeting we had with Joel last year as part of the Blue Wren Group and the Glebe Society, he said, couldn't see getting a bush care officer and a bush care officer meaning a person who's going to work with the community to facilitate, activities on an ongoing basis on, sort of managing restoration works in some of the parks, sort of habitat restoration activities. So they're really, the contractors they've used, and even the bush regeneration contractors they've used are the cheapest, and they're not actually, they've got a pretty bad reputation at the moment around the industry traps.
I guess if people are pulling things out that can't go well in community
perspective. So it is gradually kind of, there've been internal ructions as well as relationship breakdowns with the city, but I think there's a planting day this week, I think, actually, and on Wednesday at Paddy Gray. So, it's nice to see. I think it's good, and it's interesting that the group coalesced around this concept of the wrens. Now the wrens are pretty much gone, but the group's still there, and it's still kind of work. And I think they have seen the odd wren. I think probably the Sydney University family of wrens is probably the core. And I think sometimes they cross over Parramatta Road, which is an extraordinary concept. But we think that that's probably what happens, because we can't see them sort of... They pop up every now and again in Glebe, but we can't sort of see them sort of anywhere here.
I was wondering if... We were talking earlier off the tape about how Sydney has... community patches, you stick with your own patch, etc., and even within the LGA that's the case. But I was wondering if you have any familiarity with any of the other parks, or any, when you're doing bird watching, have you been to other places? And
certainly started out in Centennial Park, Lane Cove National Park, outside or within the City of Sydney you're thinking of, because obviously this is what you're writing about. Really spent as much time as I could have in Sydney Park. I think it's got great potential, but I mean, any park you build on a garbage dump has its challenges, landscaping wise. It's good. I have stopped. If I'm driving past, I sometimes stop in. Always have a pair of binoculars in the car. And I've seen sort of a couple of interesting birds there. The little mannequins. So it was which sort of mannequin was it? One of the mannequins. I can't remember. Grebe. Some of the water birds are interesting. Elsewhere, it's always been nice to see sort of white-faced herons there around the waterways, the foreshore. There was an egret on Anzac Day down in Johnson's Creek, and I emailed Katie and I said the last one I recorded in Rosal Bay was 1991, but she said she'd seen one in 2010, so there we go. Down here in the park, started about...
What's the park?
Well, it's Federal Park. It's part of it's Leichhardt, but then it goes into the City of Sydney. So the canal, the Johnson's Creek is a not quite the dividing line though, because it moves out. I think it's not even, and Wentworth Park, there's always been Willy Wagtails there. And over summer I was walking back from the fish markets and there was a little peewee, and it must have been a juvenile peewee because its colour was different. It had sort of, I came back and checked, and their eyes are a different colour. Well, that's nice. And the peewees are breeding down there. And peewees and Willy Wagtails are quite happy with that open sort of grassland. And you often see... You often see sort of the welcome swallows and things like that. There are little birds around. And they're elsewhere in the city. Well, obviously the botanic gardens, not as much as there used to be. I guess again, more people, less wildlife.
And they've had that powerful owl.
Yes. I still haven't ever seen it down there, but I know Richard's seen it a few times. Obviously, anyone who's around there would. I don't think Centennial Park's part of the city of Sydney.
A little bit, not very much, but a bit.
Yeah. So that's a great resource for an urban park. It's more the incidental sightings, I think, that are nice. And again, it's be nice to think people could be more observant and kind of recognise that nature's with us, not out there somewhere.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the message that those of us who sort of care about wildlife would like, you know, spread that sense of... But how you do it is... obviously very challenging, and you're never going to be able to, you know, bring back what we had. But I think there's still a lot of potential in all these new developments to try and do something. But you know, I mean, you have your birdcage displays and things. I think that's a bit sad, really. Angel Place of the City of Sydney's got a, you know...
I haven't seen it yet. Yeah.
I mean, it's nice as an art piece, but it's kind of sad. To me, it's sad. Mm.
Right.
And I guess the challenge is when you've been in a place a long time is to reconcile with the change. I'm not sure whether I'm reconciled or not.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I can
see that. Well, are there anything else that
I don't
you...
think I think that's probably covers most of the things that I have to say that may be of interest.
It's all been quite fascinating.
Water? I think I've probably covered everything really, Jo.
Thank you.
That's